and refreshing. So he's got half of his stuff in one place and half in another, but hopefully this will work for us. It looks
I
good.
think so.
Yeah.
Good, perfect. Okay, sounds good. Okay, so I'll get started. I think I've participated in one of these before with Dr. Malcheski. So just a reintroduction, my name is Philip Hurst. I'm the pulmonary fellow here in Rochester this year. And so I'll kick us off with this first article by Mickey Adams and et al. And this is a paper that looked at comparing whole slide imaging versus microscope glass evaluation for PD-L1 immunohistochemistry, and comparing interpretation between the two and making sure that they are or are not concordant. And so they just cite a couple other kind of prominent studies that have looked at sort of validating the use of whole slide imaging for clinical pathology. But that nobody had specifically looked at evaluating and grading PD-L1 IHC for validation for clinical use. So they wanted to do that, and to do so, they took over 700 surgical biopsy specimens from 14 different tumor types. That include, I won't read them all, but I mean, include small cell and non-small cell lung cancer. And we can look at those tables here in a minute. And then they had a group of 14, sorry, 17 readers that included both pathologists and trained readers, trained IHC evaluators based on the company that created the IHC. And they scored them both after their evaluation from the whole slide imaging and also from microscopic glass evaluation. There was a washout period between their reviews, but otherwise, it was a pretty straightforward study in terms of methodology. And then, of course, they just compared the concordance from before and after. So, here is just the cohort of slides that they selected based on. So, they had these are the 14 different cancer types, of course. Here are the total number of specimens they had for each one in the middle. And then they pre-selected ones that had been described as positive or negative that they could then use as kind of, their standardized set of cases. So when they reevaluated these with their 17 readers, we get the results here. And what they found overall, some salient findings, is that across all tumor types, the average agreement was 89%. So, pretty decent overall. Some tumor types showed 100% agreement, and that included ovarian carcinoma, renal cell carcinoma, and small cell lung carcinoma. There were a few that showed lower correlation that included, sorry, I should say, their concordance correlation coefficient. So that includes prostate carcinoma, small cell lung carcinoma, and urothelial carcinoma, which had lower CCCs, but as I already mentioned, small cell lung cancer still had overall agreement. So where this article, I think, gets a little bit interesting and where it highlights some of the challenges is, as we all know, a lot of these tumor types, they kind of live at that lower percent positivity. So if the CPS or the TPS is greater than or equal to 1%, they might have a subset of cells that are positive, but the question then becomes, does it equal 1% or greater? And so that's where this column about the NCO or the near cutoff negative comes into play, because that's this subset of cases where there are some cells that are staining positive, but it was felt that they did not meet the threshold to be calling it positive. And so the tumor types that sort of inherently live in that zone are obviously the ones that have the most discrepancies and disconcordance. So we know, for example, that small cell lung cancer, like, they often are very positive or very negative. And so for that reason, they had the 100% concordance rate overall with positive and negative. But because they did have a subset of cells that could be, challenging to interpret, they had that increased CCC. With all that being said, the 11 of the 14 tumor types had a concordance correlation coefficient of greater than 85 point or 0.85, which indicated a relatively low scoring variability. And we can also see that in their scatter plots. here. And this is kind of a nice visual to see all of the specimens studied, from the whole study, where you can see that the yellow dots are the discordant cases, which are very few, and they all tend to be at that lower percent positivity. So those kind of near cutoff negative areas. And then that for virtually every single tumor, I mean, in fact, every single tumor type, there is a correlation, a positive correlation. So for the most part, very reliable. Some of the challenges that they point out are that there were a small subset of readers who tended to slightly overcall or increase their percent called on whole slide images, but it was not significant, and it did not correlate. There was no systemic bias for the whole slide images versus the glass. So for example, it would not be consistent across all tumor types. They concluded ultimately that these were that whole slide imaging and glass slide review were concordant enough that it was an acceptable way to evaluate these IHC gradings. Yes, so encouraging, I think, for us since we use whole slide imaging, or at least I'm sure some of us do. And hopefully we can continue to feel confident that our interpretations are appropriate.
Philip, did they give any ideas for why there were some readers had a tendency to overread, or to increase have an increase of their percentage on the whole slide imaging compared to glass?
I don't think they specifically said
Okay.
why. I think they just pointed out that it was a small number of pathologists and it was like inconsistent. And so
Okay.
that's why they felt that it was more related to the pathologist's interpretation rather than the methodology. But I don't think they had any like comment area for the pathologist to say, to reflect on that.
Thanks for presenting that, Philip. I guess PD-L1 never gets old. There's another study now. The funny thing is, in the end, I don't think anyone knows who is right because they don't have any outcome studies here. I mean, is their reading on the whole slide imaging right? Is their reading on the glass slide right? I don't think we know. Is the
That's a
reading
great point.
right overall? I mean, yeah. Because they don't do any outcome studies, no correlation with PD-L1 treatment.
Yeah. Well, and that's a really interesting point. And in fact, I was thinking about that to some degree, kind of related is, when they chose then when they pre-selected these tumors based on their original, call of positive or negative, there was obviously a subset of tumors that after review by a group of 17 people changed from positive to negative or vice versa. And so, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Unless we're going to have 17 people review every PD-L1, then I don't know if we can get a confident answer on what's, which one's right or what's
Yeah.
more likely to be right.
They even chose tumors that we usually wouldn't even do PD-L1 on, like small cell lung carcinoma. To my knowledge, it's not treated
Yeah.
with PD-L1 usually. So, but
Yeah.
interesting. Thank you.
Margaret, were you trying to? I think you had your hand up.
Oh.
Sorry, we can't. Your audio is not is cutting in and out. Do you want to? Can you type it in the chat? Sorry for the long comment. Was there somebody else that wanted to?
Well,
Yes,
I have a question.
okay,
Sorry.
go
Yeah.
Ying Chun and then
So
Henry.
I'm curious about what the NCO means or what the performance of the NCO. So they kind of like they define the NCO is like 0 to 10. But the cutoff is 1 if they use, but sure. So the NCO will include all the negatives
That's
plus
right.
some low positive, but the NCO negatives are small number. So I got a little confused of what that can you explain that?
I
And
can
then
try.
plus if they see anything interesting in NCO, because I know sometimes we struggle is like 1% or above or less, right? So does glass or whole slide imaging have any performance difference in their range?
I don't think
two questions,
so.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, I don't think there was a major difference in terms of like the, I think that's what this was looking at was, you know, all for the vast majority of these tumor types in the vast majority of these cases, tumors that we already know to be kind of in that lower percent positive and sort of thereby in that near cutoff range perform the same both in glass and on in whole slide imaging. So going back to your question about like, you know, what exactly is NCO? Yes. So the near cutoff negatives are all a subset of true negatives. And you're right. So the range that they describe as near cutoff was 0 to 10%. But obviously if it's greater than 1%, it's that near cutoff positive. So truly the near cutoff negatives are just the ones that have some positivity but cannot meet the threshold for 1%.
Okay. So but does that number should include all the total negatives?
Not if it was flat negative, right? If it was flat negative with no staining at all, they probably didn't include it, I would imagine.
That's right. I probably misspoke.
Okay, so it has to be
0 to 10%. It should be 1 to 10%
or
above any staining to 10%. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Henry.
Yeah, nothing. You can
okay.
move on.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Philip.
Yeah.
Let me try to get our share switched over here. Can you all see my PDF? Can you guys
yes.
see that?
Yes.
Okay, yep. Perfect. All right. So I'm going to do this one next. So this is an article from JTO describing the clinical and pathologic phenotyping of mesotheliomas developing in carriers of germline BAP1 mutations. So I thought this was pretty interesting. So as we know, germline BAP1 heterozygous inactivating mutations cause the BAP1 cancer syndrome. So those patients are going to have an increased risk of not only mesothelioma, but also uveal melanoma, clear cell renal cell carcinoma, and other malignancies as well. And that's transmitted in an autosomal dominant fashion. And it's estimated, they say it's estimated that 8 to 16% of all mesotheliomas occur in patients either with a germline BAP1 mutation or other germline mutation in a different tumor suppressor gene. So they cite some prior work that showed that mesotheliomas and BAP1 carriers have markedly prolonged survival, an average of 7 years, compared to the survival in sporadic mesotheliomas, which is only 6 to 18 months. So they aim to really define the clinical course and distinctive histopathologic phenotype of mesotheliomas arising in this group of BAP1 mutation carriers and compare those with sporadic mesotheliomas. So how they did that, they studied 238 individuals with germline BAP1 mutations across 47 different families. They collected those from 1999 to 2003, and then they tried to just characterize them. They also compared those to 123 relatives of those patients that did not have germline mutations. So they were not carriers, even though they were in the same family cohorts. So they found 34 distinct pathogenic BAP1 mutations. Most of them were truncating and completely inactivating. And then they also did some immunohistochemistry, calretinin, WT1, and keratin. They counted as their meso markers. Their carcinoma markers included things like claudin-4, MOC31, BURI-P, TTF1, P40, PAX8, pretty standard. So, and then when they did their BAP1 immunostaining, they tried to really carefully assess that in what they considered invasive and non-invasive areas. So I'm just going to scroll down so you can look at some pictures while I talk through their results. All right, so the 34 inactivating BAP1 mutations were identified in those 47 families. Very interestingly, they had 10 families from around the country that had the exact same mutation, and they traced that mutation back to an ancestor that immigrated to the U.S. in 1717. And these families didn't know each other or know necessarily that they were related, so I thought that was kind of neat. But the 238 carriers demonstrated a female predominance of about 1.5 to 1. So that was kind of an interesting observation. It wasn't statistically significant. It almost was, but it was not. But it does raise the possibility that the mutation may be preferentially lethal to males during embryological development. So of those 238 carriers that they studied, 84 of them developed mesothelioma. None of the 123 BAP1 wild type family members or relatives developed mesothelioma. So 53% of carriers between the ages of 30 and 49 had at least one malignancy, compared to only 6.7% of wild-type relatives. So it's particularly conspicuous in the younger cohorts that these carriers are developing malignancies at a relatively young age. In the age 60 to 69 cohort, 93% of patients had developed one malignancy versus 20%. So we see those carrier or those non-carriers are developing a kind of more age-related malignancies. In all, 45.2% of the carriers had additional malignancies, up to four other malignancies in addition to, those are the ones that develop mesothelioma. So of the 38 that, of the 84 that developed mesothelioma, 45% of them had another malignancy as well. And some of them had multiple other malignancies, up to four. So most of these cases are occurring at a younger age, a median of 54 years, which is about 20 years younger than sporadic mesothelioma. Only one of their patients had asbestos exposure. And uveal melanoma was the second most common malignancy. And interestingly, in the very young patients, the 20 to 29-year-old age group, uveal melanoma was the most common malignancy. It was more common than mesothelioma in that group. And then clear cell renal cell carcinoma was the third most common, as we might expect. So as far as what they saw at surgery, here are some pictures. So these kind of flat, slightly raised, whitish plaque-like lesions that are multifocal. So they described a multifocal 1 to 3 millimeter whitish serosa lesions on the pleura and peritoneum. These often were not visible on imaging. So a CT scan would just show an effusion. So most of the time when they did these surgeries and found these lesions, it was because the patient had persistent effusions. So they had central pathologic review in 23 cases. And so I'm not sure if I zoom in a little bit more, if that might help you see this better. And they describe some characteristic histological features. So they describe background diffuse mesothelial hyperplasia with some foci even showing architectural complexity. They describe as tubulopapillary or trabecular epithelioid growth at the surface that is non-invasive and BAP1 retained. And then they frequently had what they described as superficial invasion by the mesothelioma that they describe developing in this syndrome. I think this kind of pattern is familiar to us, this kind of very dense collagenous stroma with these very bland cords of mesothelial cells infiltrating through there. And then here, I think this is kind of an interesting picture where they try to show they have populations of cells with BAP1 loss that in these areas of kind of invasive growth, but they have this weird looking kind of mesothelial hyperplasia at the surface as well that is BAP1 retained. So they describe this very common pattern of a very collagenous stroma, increased lymphocytes, but then they also describe at the surface this, in some patients, this kind of papillary proliferation at the mesothelial surface, some of which is BAP1 retained, so that they really relied on the BAP here to almost define what they called mesothelioma versus what they called hyperplasia, which is I think interesting, particularly in these patients where we know they have one hit already. Even the cells with a retained BAP1 can show pretty abnormal architecture. I mean, this is pretty scary looking papillary proliferation at the surface with retained BAP1 expression. And then other areas, more confluent growth here with BAP1 loss. They say that the mesotheliomas they observed in these patients usually were superficial only. They did not usually invade deeply, and they did not observe any sarcomatoid mesotheliomas at all in this cohort. The tumors, in addition to being epithelioid, are typically low grade. So they actually propose a new terminology for these tumors, which they call LBAM, low-grade BEP1-associated mesothelioma, to distinguish them biologically from those more aggressive lesions. So most patients did survive a long time. So median survival was 7 years. Some patients, I think including this one here with this papillary proliferation that kind of looks like a well-differentiated papillary mesothelioma, but they say had areas of invasion. She declined therapy and was alive and well years later after the biopsy. They did have a few patients that had aggressive behavior. So they had three patients essentially that had a behavior that was more in keeping with sporadic mesothelioma. Those patients had solid architecture, they had high nuclear grade, they had deeply invasive growth. So features that would make us think, you know, more of a classical sporadic mesothelioma. Including this one, which this patient had mesothelioma invading into the duodenum. So those three patients all died within 1 year that had all of those poor prognostic factors. So the conclusions of this study were that mesotheliomas arising in germline BAP1 carriers represent biologically, histologically, and clinically distinctive disease. They do fulfill current criteria for malignant mesothelioma because they're invasive and they have BAP1 loss, but most of them are very indolent compared to sporadic mesotheliomas. They may remain superficial for years, and they say that it might not warrant aggressive therapy up front and might be more of a watch and see kind of a thing for some of these patients. So BAP1 loss doesn't always equal aggressive mesothelioma, particularly in these germline cancers. They also point out that they often have multi-cavity superficial disease that should not automatically imply that they have metastatic or stage 4 multi-cavity disease. So germline BAP1 status is both a risk marker but also a favorable prognostic biomarker. So if you see, you know, this characteristic histology, if you see multifocal disease, if you see weird widespread hyperplasia in the background mesothelium, all of these should prompt a consideration of a germline BAP1 mutation carrier. So I think that's it in a nutshell. Any questions, comments about this one?
Well, it's an interesting story. Oh, sorry, please go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I find it an interesting story. The thing is, probably when we make a diagnosis of mesothelioma at that time, first of all, they often don't know about diagnosis, so they won't have done the germline testing. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not aware of a case that I ever knew that they had done the germline testing. So the diagnosis of LBAM, I'm not sure how we are able to make that.
Right. Yeah, I feel kind of the same. I feel like maybe it would be something that we might suggest based on young age or, you know, the morphology of the tumor or something along those lines. But knowing it prospectively would be hard for us, I think, in most cases. I don't recall a case either where I've gotten a specific history of this mutation before I interpreted the biopsy.
Yeah, what I was going to say was I don't know if you want to scroll down, but I think that first set of images, that G with that hyperplasia, I mean, to me, that's mesothelioma.
I know. It's like regardless of the BAP1 being retained right. In that area, it's exactly. Hard to ignore that architectural complexity.
Yeah, exactly. To me, tibia. That's just way too much.
This one
yeah,
here?
That yeah. G1. Yeah, right, mm-hmm. Right. So to me, that's just way too much, and I would call that mesothelioma, regardless of whether the BAP1, you know, was positive or negative, you know, retained or not. So
yeah, and they have another terminology that's even, I think, a little bit more clunky to describe that, which, again, I get what they're saying, but it's, you know, it's basically calling it mesothelioma in situ in the germline setting. But, again, hard to know how we would know that ahead of time without that history.
Does everybody do BAP1 on every case? I've never had a clinician come back to me and say, please do BAP1 because I want to know whether it, you know, thinking that it's prognostically significant. I've had no one come back to me and say, would you please do a BAP1 on this mesothelioma? So I don't know what the, experience of the group is, I mean, there are some in the mesothelioma world that say you should do it on every one, but I've never had anybody ask for it if I don't do it.
Yeah, I don't,
and I never got the question.
No, I've never gotten that question.
Have any been asked if the? Can you hear me? Sorry.
Yeah, we can hear you, Margaret.
We can hear you.
Now we can. Great. I've only been asked when the patient's son died of a melanoma, and then he asked me to check.
Yeah.
Because she had a mesothelioma. She already had a meso. But what I find the opposite is that pathologists ask me for BAP1 all the time, and if it's intact, they won't make the diagnosis.
Yeah.
If it's flagrantly looking like a mesothelioma. And then the oncologists are like, oh, we can't make this diagnosis, you know, what's going on here? So they're relying on it too much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I only have been doing it in the setting of these things, like you said, that look well differentiated papillary, to make sure that it's retained if I'm favoring that it's a well differentiated papillary mesothelial tumor. And then if it's lost, to rethink that, as opposed to things that look clearly like malignant mesothelioma. I haven't been doing those.
Yeah, I would agree too. I've only really been doing it when it's like a little more ambiguous, if it is invasive or not. And then I do think like I do it also if it is a younger patient, just to see or suggest, like, so I'll do like BAP1. And then we have MTAP and Merlin here, just so in case if there is anything, you could suggest possibly there's a germline mutation. But I guess even in the absence of those being lost, I guess like I've also seen that like a BAP1 retained and then the patient also has a germline mutation. I don't know how to reconcile that either, whether it's like an issue with the stain or who knows.
Hmm. All righty. Any other comments or discussion on this one? I thought it was an interesting study. All right. And then if not, I'll move on to this one, which is again from Modern Pathology, from a Japanese group on the feasibility of histological grading system of small size pulmonary adenocarcinoma based on frozen section as a predictor for nodal metastasis. So I thought this was kind of a little bit of an interesting twist on our ability to grade on frozen section that I guess I hadn't really thought too much of before. So their background here is that identifying lymph node metastases in small, clinically N0 lung adenocarcinomas, so those that are less than 2 centimeters, is very helpful and important for surgeons when they're deciding what kind of surgical approach to do. So sublobar resections are becoming more and more common for lung cancer, and they're often associated with less complete nodal dissection. So usually less lymph nodes are sampled, they get less access to the hilum of the lung, do less of the cleaning out of the hilar lymph nodes. So they cite that 11 to 18% of clinical N0 tumor harbor occult nodal disease on final pathology. So how does that relate to grading on frozen section? Well, they say that the high-risk patterns, micropapillary solid complex glandular over 20%, so essentially the grade 3 tumor, do correlate quite strongly with lymph node metastasis and, as we know, with prognosis. So they wanted to see if it would be feasible for us to provide some information about the grade of a tumor at the time of frozen section, if it would be helpful to the surgeon in determining whether they were going to stop at a sublobar resection or maybe do a lobectomy and a more complete nodal dissection, essentially to try to capture those patients that might have occult lymph node metastases. So they did this by, it's a retrospective single institution study. They looked at 190 invasive adenocarcinomas less than 2 centimeters, and this was over the period of 2015 to 2022. They also concentrated on cases, and I'm guessing this is based on their prior work, of those with a what they call a consolidation tumor ratio of greater than 0.5. So essentially, the tumor on CT scan was less than half ground glass, so more solid than ground glass. Those are, of course, would be higher risk than those that have a consolidation tumor ratio less than 0.5, which would be a mostly ground glass nodule. They did exclude AIS and MIA cases. They excluded mucinous adenocarcinoma. They excluded multiple lesions or those that didn't have any lymph node sampling. They also describe how they obtained their frozen section, and I think it's a little different, at least, than what we would typically do here at Mayo Rochester, where we do, obviously, a pretty aggressive frozen section sampling. But they describe that they only sampled the periphery of the lesion. They avoided the central areas to avoid any necrosis or central areas of hyalinization. And if they thought they saw pleural invasion, they avoided those areas for a frozen section sample as well. They had three pathologists assigned grade. This included a resident, a general pathologist, and a pulmonary pathology expert, and they had them independently grade the slides using the IASLC system. So they did concordance measurements based on the evaluation by those three readers, and then they did a multi-headed consensus evaluation to determine the final grade, and that was what they then correlated with, like, nodal metastases. So let's scroll down here to a few of their tables. I think all of us are familiar with how to assign the IASLC grade. So when they looked at the frozen section IASLC grade between the three pathologists, there was substantial agreement with a kappa of 0.68. And the high grade pattern recognition had a kappa of 0.65, so pretty similar. After the multi-headed scope consensus assignment of grade, the frozen section grade versus the permanent section grade, final overall concordance was 75.8%. When we look at the grade-specific concordance, you can see down here in this table that grade 3 actually had the best concordance between frozen section and final pathology out of all of the grades of tumor. So grade 1 was 70%, grade 2 was 64%, and grade 3 was 95% concordance between frozen section and final. So that gave a frozen section sensitivity of about 70% and a specificity for grade 3 of about 97%. So they did have a few grade 3 tumors that were undercalled as grade 1 based on the frozen section, and they say this is because they sampled the edge and they only sampled the lipidic edge in a tumor that ended up being more aggressive towards the center of the tumor. None of those cases that were undergraded at frozen section had lymph node metastases. So in the end, their occult N1 or N2 disease was present in 12% of patients. That's 23 patients. That was 0 in grade 1 tumors, 8 in grade 2 tumors, and 15 in grade 3. So that breaks down into 9% of grade 2 tumors had occult nodal disease, and 24% of grade 3 tumors had occult nodal disease. Pure solid appearance on CT scan was also associated with metastasis, but it was less strongly associated with lymph node metastasis. And when they did a multivariate regression analysis, only the IASLC grade 3 on frozen section was an independent predictor of lymph node metastasis. The odds ratio was 4.34, and the p-value was 0.006, as you can see here in the bottom of this table. They had a few patients that had PET SUV max values from pre-operative PET scans. It showed a similar odds ratio, but they didn't have enough patients to achieve any sort of statistical significance there. So their conclusion was that IASLC grade can be applied to frozen section. It's pretty feasible, reproducible, and strongly predictive of nodal metastases in this selected group of small, so 2 centimeters or less, mostly solid on imaging pulmonary adenocarcinomas. They argue that grade 3 on frozen section is a highly reliable indicator of biologic aggressiveness with pretty high specificity, even on frozen section. And it is a predictor of a potential occult nodal disease. It supports the notion that frozen section grading could be used to guide intraoperative lymph node dissection decisions if your surgeons are looking for more guidance in that particular area. And the grade 1 tumors seem to have a very low risk of nodal metastases, at least in this cohort. Not a huge cohort, but they didn't see any nodal metastases in those that they thought were grade 1. All right, I think that's pretty much it for this one. Any comments, questions? It's not something I frequently get asked at the time of frozen section. Every once in a while, when the surgeon's on the fence about doing a sublobar resection versus a lobectomy, they'll ask some questions about, you know, how aggressive it looks and things, but that's a small minority of the time, at least right now.
High lymph node dissection, what exactly does that mean?
They had more than three lymph nodes, I think, is basically how they excluded every patient that had less than three nodal samples. So everybody had at least three areas of lymph node sampling, but it wasn't, you know, completely uniform across the board, certainly. And most of these were lobectomies. The vast majority of these were lobectomies.
So does that mean the surgeons went and looked for more lymph nodes than they normally would?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm not sure if it's just the way that they practice that they're still doing mostly lobectomies at their institution. But most of these were lobectomy with nodal dissection. Yep. Or maybe it's that they excluded most of the sublobar resections because they didn't have at least three nodal stations sampled.
Okay. I wonder if any of these diagnoses of high grade would make the surgeon convert from a wedge to a lobe, maybe, or take more tumor.
Yeah.
Or, you know, more lung to have a wider section margin.
Yeah, I think in this study, they didn't ask that specific question. I think they're postulating that that's what could be done. But yeah. I don't think they were really making any operative decisions based on this right now, because they were reviewing this and providing the grade retrospectively. It wasn't something they provided, I don't think, at the time of actual frozen section.
You know, I have a question.
Yeah, Joanne.
They said that they excluded AIS, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in less than 2 centimeter nodule, mm-hmm. with a lipidic predominant, I mean, you don't call lipidic predominant, that's grade one, is mostly lipidic, right? And you don't call that in a small tumor. It has to be greater than 3 centimeter. With mm-hmm. a lipidic predominant is grade one. So I'm just wondering what kind of a tumor, I mean, what grade tumor can be made, you know, on the 2 centimeter or less size?
That's not AIS or MIA.
It's
pretty uncommon, especially when they were already kind of biasing their cohort towards more invasive or aggressive tumors by their CT inclusion criteria of having to be mostly solid.
So mostly, okay, so it's kind of a little weird. And so pretty much,
They're kind of weeding out a lot of that low-grade stuff, which, so, your point is well taken. Like what were their grade one tumors actually?
Yeah, and then, you know, the grade two, even if a low amount, then grade three still has a, 8%, I guess that's a significant chance of having metastasis. So I guess...
in grade two?
Yeah, in grade two.
Yeah.
And the grade one is really kind of a rare in this setting. So, mm-hmm. you know, just go for no dissection.
Yeah. Any other comments? If not, I will just go over this last one real briefly. So I thought this was an interesting article because I'm interested in these sorts of tumors, but I thought it might be worth just looking at a few pictures from this article and being aware of this entity. So this is from Dipali Jain and her group. They're describing ELK rearranged malignant mesenchymal neoplasms of the thorax. Therapeutically targetable ELKOMAs beyond the spectrum of non-small cell lung cancer and thoracic inflammatory myofibroblastic tumor. So this is essentially a report of three cases, but in their background, they describe, we know that ELK fusions, of course, are well-established oncogenic drivers in various tumor types, including lung adenocarcinoma, IMT, epithelioid fibrous histiocytoma, among other things. but they are talking more about a kind of a new family of ELK rearranged mesenchymal neoplasms that are distinct from these entities. There's about 29 cases reported currently in the literature that are predominantly in deep soft tissue in children and young adults. They're usually low-grade spindle cell neoplasms. It seems like they have a lot in common with the NTRK rearranged mesenchymal tumors, at least have been described to have co-expression of CD34 and S100 and have quite a bit of variability in morphology and grade. But the important thing is that these tumors have been described in some patients to respond really well to ELK inhibitors. And therefore, you know, if they occur in the thorax, we would want to identify them because potentially it could have therapeutic implications. So basically they found three patients who had, these tumors in the thorax. So that was a retrospective review. This was over about 5 years that they encountered three of these lesions. They excluded, you know, IMT, epithelioid fibrous histiocytoma based on morphologic features. They had IHC panels done to exclude other things kind of in the differential diagnosis, and all of them had ELK rearrangement confirmed by break apart FISH. So they found these three thoracic ELK rearranged mesenchymal tumors. The patients ranged from 25 to 33 years, so all quite young. They were all non-smokers, two men and one woman. Two of three had mets at presentation, so these were potentially quite aggressive. So metastatic sites included brain, scalp, and non-regional lymph nodes. One patient responded to crizotinib. One died within a week of starting crizotinib because of the high stage at which they presented, and then they didn't have follow-up on the third patient. So histologically, I thought they were kind of interesting. Again, let me just see if I can zoom in a little closer here, maybe get you a better look. So they were relatively monomorphic spindle to epithelioid morphology, with a variable stroma that ranged from myxoid to sclerotic or collagenous. Contrast to IMT, they usually didn't have a background inflammatory infiltrate. They described it as mild to absent. They often had hemangiopericytoma-like vasculature, and some of the cases showed rhabdoid cells, which is present in the other case. So I'll just show you here. Yeah, this one is very monotonous, kind of round cells. I wouldn't have really thought of IMT by looking at it, but they have this diffuse strong expression of ELK. This one also co-expressed S100, which is in D, and negative for CD34 with rearrangement by FISH. And then let me just show you this other one that they illustrate here that looks more scary. So these cells are more rhabdoid. It has entrapped lung parenchyma within it. More pleomorphism in the cells, but still, again, very strong staining for ELK. They did have necrosis present in two of the three cases. The mitotic activity index, it was mitotically active, so 3 to 8 per high power field in the higher grade tumor. And the one that was that lower grade tumor that we looked at just a minute ago had a low mitotic index. So again, quite a range of malignancy appearing in the cells. And so all of them had positive ELK staining. Keratin was negative in all. All had retained INI1. All had retained H3K27ME3. And contrary to the literature, which describes frequent co-expression of CD34 and S100 in these tumors, they say that these thoracic ELKomas may lack both. So all were CD34 negative and only one had S100 positivity. So they seem to be rare aggressive tumors occurring in young non-smoking patients. They may present with metastatic disease, and they may unfortunately kind of lack distinctive morphologic or immunohistochemical features that would tip you off. So they basically say if you have a difficult to characterize tumor in a young patient that's not a smoker, always remember to include ELK immunostain in your workup. And if you get really strong expression, think about something in this family, since they do not always look like an IMT, and you could potentially identify a therapeutic avenue for these patients, especially if they're presenting at that high stage. So I thought that was kind of an interesting one. Any comments or questions on that?
You mentioned the ELK. I mean, we the only setting I really do an ELK is thinking about an IMT, although usually somebody else comes with, you know, somebody else has sent it in. But that looks really strong. I mean, you said strong,
yep.
But
yeah,
that's
really, really strong.
That's way stronger than, like, an IMT, right?
Usually yeah, well, usually, both. Yeah, it's more the granular cytoplasmic staining. It looks more like the staining pattern we see in like an ALK rearranged lung cancer, right? I think, and I'm not sure why that is, but yeah, I agree. The IMTs usually have more of a not quite so intense staining pattern.
Well, I think that the ALK staining also depends on the fusion partner.
Yeah.
So, okay. I mean, having nuclear versus cytoplasmic strongly and so on.
Okay. Yeah, because this one looks cytoplasmic, I guess, not really nuclear.
That is above my pay grade.
Anyway, I just thought it was interesting. You know, every once in a while you get
about ALK stains. That's why I want to
Yeah.
It's above my pay grade. That's why I sent it to you guys.
Just something to keep in your back pocket if you ever run into something that you're having trouble figuring out what the heck is going on with it. And I think in a young patient, a lot of these would go to NGS anyway before we give up on it. But something we might be able to pick up based on IHC, at least to follow it up with your ALK staining or ALK molecular. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, I think we're out of time. So thank you, everyone, for joining today. I hope everybody has a happy holiday and get some time to relax.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Happy holidays.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.